The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, as Planck sends back a postcard of our universe, we talk about the cosmic microwave background.
So the splotches are really hot and cold spots. So if you had microwave eyes and you looked at the sky, what you would see is a completely uniform background.
And the high-tech way that the data is processed.
You take a calculation, you split it up into, say, a few dozen or 100 bits, and you hand it off into each little bit into one of the little pizza boxes.
It should perhaps come as no surprise to you that we also have one of the world's greatest living physicists on the programme. Ed Witten attempts to untangle string theory for us.
Of the many valleys in different parts of the megaverse, many of them are unsuitable for life. The constants have the wrong values. There aren't complex structures. Everything is blasted apart at an incredible speed. We, of course, don't live in the regions that we can't live in. We live in a region that is favorable for us.
Another report's been published into those leaked climate change emails, and new evidence suggests that humans made it to Britain much earlier than we previously thought.
We don't know if these people knew how to harness fire. We don't know if they had any kind of rudimentary clothing or any means of making basic shelters. So they're basically just kipping out in the wild.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. A happy Monday to you all. Anecdotal evidence, by the way, points to this podcast being the best way to start your week. In the studio today, we have Hiranya Peeris, a cosmologist at University College London. She studies the fossilised heat of the Big Bang, the cosmic microwave background, also known as the CMB. What is that, I hear you ask? Well, you can actually see this stuff for yourself. About 1% of the snow picked up by an untuned television arises from this radiation. Hiranya is a member of the Planck collaboration, using the European Space Agency's Planck satellite. Hiranya came into the studio to speak to science correspondent Ian Sample. He began by asking her about the quality of the data the satellite's sending back.
So the first time I saw some data from Planck was 2 weeks after it was launched, and it had reached the L2 Lagrange point and sent back its first data. And I literally couldn't stop smiling for a week because it was just so beautiful. And just after 2 weeks, to see the sensitivity and the resolution and the quality of the data was just astonishing. Having worked with CMB data for about 10 years, it's just a leap forward in the precision with which we can understand the properties of the early universe. So Planck is a cosmic microwave background satellite. It's a European Space Agency project with huge involvement from many countries in Europe, including the UK and also the US. It's currently taking data at what's called the second Lagrange point, which is very, very far away. It's beyond the orbit of the moon. And it's sitting out there. It's very cold. And it's studying the universe in the microwave frequencies. So why is that interesting? It's because these microwaves come from the very early universe. When the universe was very, very young, it was full of this plasma of electrons and protons, because it was so hot that all the atoms were dissociated into their components. As the universe expanded, it cooled, and as it cooled, it eventually became cold enough that the plasma collapsed back into neutral atoms. And before this event, the radiation or light in the universe is bouncing around with the electrons. And once the atoms had formed, then the light couldn't bounce off and scatter off electrons anymore. And suddenly the universe became transparent to light. And this light has been traveling to us from this event. That was about 400,000 years after the Big Bang. The universe is now about 14 billion years old. And that light, because the universe is expanding, its wavelength has been stretched out. So what started off as very, very high energy radiation has now, you know, formed into the microwave band because the wavelength has stretched out so much. So by studying this light, we can study the conditions of the very early universe. When we say the very early universe, we are actually talking about what set the initial conditions for all the structures that we see in the universe today. these initial conditions contained the imprint of physics that was at such high energy scales that they can never be probed from particle accelerators here on Earth. So it's our only chance, really, to study the physics at these really, really extreme energy scales.
Hiranya, I was looking at the first image, I believe, that had come from the Planck satellite last week. It's a beautiful, stunning image of which shows gas and dust clouds, very bright lights, and I'm sure it was a false colour image. Sort of yellowy-green speckles among a fairly sort of dark magenta background. Take me through how that works.
So when you look at this image that came from the Planck press release, as you comment rightly, a lot of what you can see there is microwaves coming from our own galaxy. And the satellite actually images in many frequencies so that we can separate out the light from our galaxy and take it away so we can study these splotches, as you call them. So the splotches are really hot and cold spots. So if you had microwave eyes and you looked at the sky, what you would see is a completely uniform background at about 2.73 degrees Kelvin. So the splotches are actually subtracting off that background, so you can see variations in one part in 100,000. It seems remarkable that you can learn about, say, cosmic inflation by studying this, but what really matters is the statistical properties of these hot and cold spots. What is their distribution as a function of their temperature, for example, and you can make very precise predictions from a model of inflation for what the statistical distribution of these spots should be. And then you compare it with what's observed, and you can discriminate between different theories that come from completely different physical origins and see what matches what we do see on the sky. So this is how you can learn from these splotches about the early universe.
And these greater pictures, which I presume were composites, as well. I mean, you've seen those as well, obviously.
Oh, yes. So what's actually been released is a very low resolution version of the data. And so there's a policy in the Planck collaboration that we don't want to release pictures of the cosmic microwave background taken by Planck before we've had a chance to examine the data fully, characterize it well, and characterize also the properties of the experiment, because without that kind of precision, we can't get to the precision on cosmology that we need. And so we don't want to release preliminary data and just put it out into the wild, as it were, because, you know, it's not very useful. So the actual data that we can see within the collaboration will only be released late 2012. And it really does need that amount of time to be able to say with confidence that we understand the experiment to the level that's necessary to do the science.
Cosmologists hope to understand something about perhaps cosmic inflation from looking at the Planck data. But what other things are there that you hope to learn from it? Presumably that it is more, there is more to it than understanding inflation. Could this tell us anything about dark energy that supposedly drives the expansion of the universe, or this dark matter that clusters around galaxies?
Yes, you can. So in addition to studying the early universe, Planck data will tell us also about the late time universe. So what you see in those splotches is a baby picture of the universe when it was 400,000 years old. So what we can do then is to use a model of cosmology, which contains things like dark matter and dark energy, to extrapolate forward what you see in the baby picture to what you see now, and compare it with current data. And this comparison tells you something about how the universe has evolved between this very early time and this very late time. That's an enormous span in time, as you can imagine. And that will allow you to come up with, if the dark matter was in this particular form, the statistical properties that you would see in the late time universe compared to the early time universe will change depending on what that model of dark matter is or how much dark matter there is. For dark energy, the constraint is a little bit more indirect. So there's a particular physical scale that's imprinted in this baby picture of the universe, and that a scale can be thought of as a ruler, and we know the size of it. And what we see on our sky now is a projection of that ruler. So it's as if, you know, you take a foot ruler and you hold it at different distances from your eye, and it appears projected as different angular sizes, right? So then you know the size, you know how big it looks to you, you can work out something about how far it is from you. And that indirect constraint is what's going to constrain dark energy.
The data you're getting from Planck must take a phenomenal amount of number crunching. I mean, can you tell me about the sort of computing power you need to do this sort of job?
Yes. So we have to use a very high level and large supercomputing facilities and data centers in order to process this data. There are several countries, including the UK and France and the US, where this data is being processed. In terms of what I do with the data, I deal with it after it has been reduced into a particular form where you've already formed these maps and calculated the statistical properties. And what we then have to do is to generate millions of different theories of the early universe, for example, and say, okay, if the theory is this, this is what my sky will look like. Then I do a comparison with the actual data we see. And you have to do that millions of times. And each of these different models has a fingerprint almost that that is your prediction for what should be on the sky. And if this fingerprint doesn't match what's observed, then you reject it and you move on. So this kind of number crunching requires immense amounts of computing power. So the kind of computer facilities we work with have many, many nodes. By a node, I mean like an element of a computer which looks like a little pizza box. And you stack all of these little pizza boxes in a very cold room. And there's a wonderful guy who actually manages the system and helps you when your codes encounter some kind of strange bug or something like that. And what we have to do then is to use these nodes in a parallelized system. So the computer codes that I use are parallelized so that you take a calculation, you split it up into, say, a few dozen or 100 bits, and you hand it off into each little bit into one of the little pizza boxes. And then it does its number crunching, and then it sends it back to the central node, and then that combines everything together and sends me the result. So it's like science fiction when you see one of these rooms. It's beautiful.
Hirani, you've worked in at Princeton in New Jersey in the US and at Cambridge in the UK, and you're now at UCL, obviously. From your perspective, I mean, what's your view of UK science right now? I mean, it seems to be certainly an interesting time. What are your feelings on the future? Are you confident? Are you optimistic?
I hope I can be optimistic, and I hope that people, and especially the government, recognizes the value that science adds to the society and the economy and the culture of the United Kingdom. Of course, the United Kingdom has had a very long historical tradition of supporting science, and I hope this continues into the future. In terms of the funding issues of scientific research, it should be recognized that not just applied science, but basic research contributes immensely to the long-term future of a country. And what happens usually if you don't recognize that, if you don't use something, you lose it. And there's the possibility of a brain drain of the brightest and smartest scientists then moving on to places where they can actually achieve their science. People that want to do science and in a very passionate way, you know, really, really care about it, and it's their life, and they think about it all the time. Like, you know, I can't just go home at 5 o'clock and stop thinking about my research. It's something that consumes you, and you go wherever allows you to do that. And I'm afraid that that could happen to a large number of very bright young people if there isn't the opportunity to do the science that they want to do.
What do you think scientists over here really need to see or hear to put their fears at rest? I mean, what are the kind of signs that you'd like to be see coming out of government that will make you think actually maybe things will be okay?
Perhaps what we would like to hear from ministers is that there is an appreciation within the government that scientific research and not just short-term applied research, which has, you know, economic impact immediately, is actually considered as valuable and important and as seen as making a contribution to the United Kingdom.
Hiranya Pieris there talking to Ian Sample. You can see the beautiful picture of our universe that they were talking about at guardian.co.uk/science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
One of the world's leading scientists was in London recently to pick up the 2010 Isaac Newton Medal of the Institute of Physics. Edward Witten is a leading researcher in superstring theory and supersymmetric quantum field theories at the Institute of Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey. He also has the highest H index of any living physicist, although I've got no idea what that actually means. Professor Witten has been awarded this latest honour for his profound contributions which have transformed particle theory and general relativity. Ian Sample caught up with him after he delivered this year's Isaac Newton lecture.
Theoretical physics basically has two sides. One is discovering the laws of nature, and the other is solving them in different situations and understanding how matter actually works. The side of it that I've been most interested in is trying to understand better what the laws of nature are. And the reason I work in string theory is that I think it's the most interesting avenue we have for trying to go beyond the laws of nature as we currently understand them.
What personal satisfaction do you get out of doing this? Is there something in this which appeals to you, which is about elegance, beauty, these kind of Dirac ideas?
The ideas in modern physics really are very elegant and surprising. That's true without worrying about contemporary things like string theory. It's amazing that the world is quantum mechanical. Quantum mechanics is very different from our intuition, and it's remarkable that it works. And when you understand how the quantum theories work, it often is very elegant and surprising. For example, Paul Dirac's discovery of antimatter as a theoretical consequence of trying to understand the electron in relativistic quantum theory, that was a beautiful discovery, as well as something that was, of course, in an astonishingly short time, confirmed experimentally in cosmic rays. When Dirac suggested antimatter would exist, and it was then confirmed, it seemed impossibly far away from practical applications. But for those of you who have had a PET scan in a hospital or know someone who's had one, the P in PET scan is for positron, which refers to a type of antimatter.
Can you describe a string theorist's view of the world to me?
String theory is a very rich theory that physicists stumbled on by a process of tinkering and successive discovery without having a clear picture of what was behind it. So we know a lot of things, but what we don't know is a lot more. It somehow is based on a modification of Einstein's conception of space and time. And this modification somehow makes quantum gravity inevitable, while in the standard framework, as far as we understand, quantum gravity seems to be impossible. That's the single biggest reason physicists have been excited about string theory. Quantum mechanics and Einstein's general relativity are the two really fundamental theories of the 20th century. They're both part of the description of nature, so we need a way to combine them and make them work together. And string theory is the only real idea we've had about how to do that.
How will we know if string theory is right?
Hopefully we'll eventually become more confident that string theory is right because of more experimental clues and probably also more theoretical insight. One of the important experimental clues that might happen if we're fortunate enough would be the discovery of supersymmetry at the Large Hadron Collider, the new accelerator near Geneva.
You were talking in your lecture about, in answer to a question about the megaverse and yes. How this may be populated, and the anthropocentric question came up. I wonder if you could just take me through your thinking on that.
The idea of the multiverse is that nature might be described by a single system of equations that have many possible solutions that you can think of as representing different valleys that the early universe might have settled into. Actually, in the modern cosmological theory that's known as the inflationary universe, it tells us that even if the whole universe started out in one valley, it would spread into other valleys. Different regions would become populated. Now, I don't know if this is the right picture of the universe, but if it is, It's pretty obvious that we wouldn't live in valleys that are too hot or too cold for us to live in. We'd live in a valley that we can live in. So the proponents of this point of view would point out that the constants of nature, as we observe them, seem to have very special values that enable complex structures and ultimately us to come into being. And their hypothesis would be that of the many valleys in different parts of the megaverse, many of them are unsuitable for life. The constants have the wrong values. There aren't complex structures. Everything is blasted apart at an incredible speed. We, of course, don't live in the regions that we can't live in. We live in a region that is favorable for us.
Ed Witten there talking to Ian Sample. If you want to follow this podcast on Twitter, look for @ScienceWeekly. We'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And to be alerted to all the Guardian Science content, follow @GuardianScience. News Jack. Let's have a quick look now at a couple of other science stories around this week. Environment correspondent David Adams joins Ian and I in the studio. First up will be the ClimateGate emails, and then we're going to talk about the first humans in Britain. ClimateGate first. After a six-month inquiry into the affair, a senior civil servant has cleared the climate scientists at the centre of a media storm over emails leaked from the University of East Anglia. They appeared to show the fudging of results to bolster the case for man-made global warming. Sir Muir Russell, however, said that the rigour and honesty of the scientists was not in doubt, but the University of East Anglia's climactic research unit was not sufficiently open. David, this subject's been rolling around for more than 6 months now. There have been three reviews into the conduct of the scientists in this whole thing. What's the difference between this last one by Muir Russell and the previous two?
Well, the one that came out last week was the big one, I suppose. The first two were largely quite quick jobs looking at quite specific parts, whereas this was the biggie. This was, did the scientists cheat? The conclusion was that effectively they've been cleared of all of the major charges. So if you take the whole spectrum of accusations they were accused of, I think they were just stopped short of eating babies, but they were accused of fiddling data, of cherry-picking information, of keeping out critical results, of covering up flaws.
They didn't do anything wrong scientifically, but perhaps they could have been more open with their work.
I think in inquiries like this, because of the dynamic, they have to hit them with something, effectively. And I think they chose to hit them on the freedom of information side, and we can come on to that. On what I consider to be the more serious charges, they can broadly be broken down into manipulating and fiddling with data and abusing their positions on the peer review system, which is the system with which the scientific community judges certain studies as good enough to publish and so forth go into the scientific record. On the fiddling data, again, there was a whole spectrum of accusations, from the fact that they tried to cover up flaws in data in China, that they cherry-picked certain reconstructions of past temperature from things like tree rings and trees in different parts of the world to try and show that global warming was a new and unusual phenomenon, down to things like, I mean, really, really detailed statistical stuff, which is frankly quite hard to explain, partly because I don't fully understand it. And effectively, they were cleared on that. In some of the cases, the Muir Russell panel did say, look, we can't really judge because we didn't really have enough evidence, but certainly in no case did they say these guys effectively did anything wrong, except for one point which is important to make. The most famous, or one of the most famous emails, was one in which Professor Jones supposedly used a trick to hide the decline, which climate skeptics said, aha, this is it, this is the smoking gun. You see, there's been a decline in temperatures which the scientists are trying to hide. Now, I mean, this was patent nonsense because, for one thing, the email was written in 1999, at which there was no decline in temperatures. We just experienced the hottest year on record, so there was no decline to hide. The panel did say that actually that email referred to a graph that was given to the World Meteorological Organization, which they did say was misleading. Now, they said there wasn't an intent to mislead there. Effectively, they stitched together different types of data on the graph and didn't make that clear on the right page next to the graph. They did explain what they did in the text, so there was clearly no attempt to hide it, but certainly they were criticized for producing a misleading graph. They were also accused of effectively abusing the peer review system by being overly critical when it wasn't deserved to try and keep papers out, both of published journals that they were involved with reviewing for, and also to keep some studies from the IPCC. Again, Muir also said no evidence of that. You know, what might look in the emails like aggressive language is just a rough and tumble of peer review, and it goes on in all disciplines. Now, they weren't completely exonerated because, as you suggested, there was quite strong criticism of this culture of secrecy and not being open enough, which, I mean, is slightly woolly, but what it boils down to effectively is this whole row, I think, kicked off because the academic scientists didn't respond properly to a certain number of requests for information. Now, there are mitigating circumstances there. You know, they knew these requests were largely designed to annoy them and to poke around to try and find sort of errors in what they'd done rather than what you would consider to be sort of genuinely scientific inquiries. But that doesn't necessarily excuse what they did. In fact, Muir Russell said it certainly did not excuse what they did. And in taking the stance that they did, in fact, he said they actually made the situation a lot worse because it created the impression that there was something to hide. So they were hit on that, and I think probably that's fair. But I just think that's a much lesser charge than the stuff that many of the people will have heard about with these emails. So effectively, this started off as a row over freedom of information, and it's ending up as a row over freedom of information.
We'll leave that there because I think there's going to be even more discussion about this next week at a debate being organised by The Guardian all about the climate change emails, featuring George Monbiot, Fred Pearce, Professor Bob Watson, former head of the IPCC and now the chief scientist at the Department for Environment here, plus others to be announced. So we'll have some more stuff from there next week. Ian, let's talk about another one of the big stories this week. Splashed over two pages in The Guardian. It's amazing, this. About the first humans to arrive on this island, Britain. Tell us
more. Yeah, although, of course, it wasn't an island at the time. I mean, the reason they arrived was that they could walk here from continental Europe. What this story really revolves around was the discovery of 78 flint tools, which were discovered at an archaeological dig on a Norfolk beach in Norfolk being in southeast England, for anyone from outside the area, near a town called Haysborough. And through various sort of ways of dating these kinds of things, the sediments around them and looking at the kinds of mammals and plant matter that was around at the time, they date back to one of two dates, either 840,000 years ago or 950,000 years ago. And the earliest evidence we had prior to this of early humans coming to Britain was about 700,000 years ago. So it you know, at best, it means that humans were here, maybe not settled, but they were here a quarter of a million years earlier than we thought. First of all, I mean, who were these early Britons? At the time, it could have been Homo erectus, one of the sort of forerunners of Homo sapiens, but more likely it was a slightly sort of more evolved version called Homo antecessor, which had slightly bigger brains, slightly smaller teeth than Homo erectus. And we know that was the only human ancestor that's actually been identified in Europe at the time. There's remains from Spain. So it may well have been guys like that who turned up. They're probably a tiny population. I mean, Britain at the time may have had, you know, a few hundreds, maybe a few thousands of people in it. But the Britain they would have arrived to find would have been probably very thick with coniferous forests. The weather actually was supposed to be pretty similar to how it is now in southern Britain. I mean, the summer temperatures, mean temperatures, would have been something like 16, 18 degrees C. The winters would have been a few degrees cooler. Now, what is really interesting about this study is that people just didn't think that early humans would have got this far north that long ago. And bear in mind, we don't know if these people knew how to harness fire. We don't know if they had any kind of rudimentary clothing or any means of making basic shelters. So they're basically just kipping out in the wild, which sort of fits with the idea previously that they hung out in the Mediterranean. They stayed in a much warmer climate than coming this far north. But what they would have done on getting to Britain, they probably would have used the ancient watercourses of things like the Thames, which now run different courses, but things like the Thames as a means to work their way into the country. So they could have lived along the banks of the Thames and on the marshes and the reed marshes and floodplains to get food along those, and rather than actually move through the forest, because they would have not been able to get through them, they didn't have the tools to sort of chop down trees and stuff.
Something interesting about this story was that the artist's impression that came with the paper, which was published in Nature, indicated that these early humans, these Homo antecessor, were living in a zoo of some sort.
You have a bit of a puzzle if you're the artist doing the impression here, because you're kind of fed a load of information from the scientists and you're told to incorporate, you know, give a flavour of what species were around. So you end up with this spectacular scene of these early human guys doing whatever they did, basically using pebbles from the river to smack bits of flint into very rudimentary cutting tools. But then you're surrounded by this wildlife park of ancient things going along, which...
all within about an acre.
All very close and apparently very, very happy around humans, even though the humans would have been chasing them and eating them. And some of them that look so spectacularly contrived, you can't believe that even evolution would have allowed them.
That picture is on our website, as is a video describing this story as well. For all that, go to guardian.co.uk/science. And for more on the Climate Gate emails, go to environmentguardian.co.uk. How does body shape affect your health? How is holographic radar saving lives in landmine-infested countries? Shape-shifting structures and climate change-detecting mollusks. Just a few of the 27 interactive exhibits in cutting-edge science, technology and engineering at the Royal Society's Summer Exhibition. It's being held at London's South Bank Centre, and we sent Heather Christie to check it out.
Right now I'm holding in my hand what is looking to be the future of iPad and Kindle and tablet technology. What it is a piece of metal that the University of Cambridge has put together that has little bits of wood on either end and is stable both flat, so you can hold it in your hand and read your favorite book or newspaper, as well as rolled up so you could toss in your bag. It's part of the shape-shifting exhibition, so let's hear what more they have to say on it.
Other types of applications are also airplane wings, because the wing of an airplane needs to be different during takeoff and during the flight. So if we manage to change the shape during operation, then we can get a better performance with the aerodynamics. We've also got over there the masts that can go up to 5 meters in height, and which can compact to something very small, which can be stored in a backpack. All of the structures, they're all based on standard material. So the TV one is based on just a copper alloy. And we just give them some extra properties by changing their original shape.
We're with Professor Chris Richardson from Bangor University. And Professor, explain sort of, you've got all these shells on this table here. So how are you using mollusks to reconstruct the climate record of the Earth?
You know how you take trees and you cut the branches of trees and look, there's a series of growth lines and growth rings in the trees. And those growth rings vary in width depending on conditions, whether it's good years of rainfall, whether there's not been a lot of sun, etc. And the trees grow very well. Some years there's droughts, there's not very good growth. Clams are the same. They contain a record of their life in the form of a series of growth lines or rings in their shell. The rings themselves are a record of how the animal has grown in the environment. And because some of these clams grow very, very old, 200 or 300 years, it gives us the opportunity to go back in time and reconstruct how the clam might have grown in the past.
So we're here with researcher Giovanna Bermano, who's the head of research for an exhibition entitled Fat Body Slim that aims to link the shape of your body with your actual physical health. Now over in the corner here, we've got a giant egg-shaped pod, probably about person-sized, that looks like someone could sit inside of it. It's got a little viewing window.
It allows you to measure body composition, mainly the percentage of fat in your body. And it does it by air displacement, meaning it measures your volume, and then it calculates your weight, it calculates the density of your body, and it can extrapolate how much fat there is.
So now we're here with Professor Cherry Wainwright, who's going to explain a little bit more about the difference between an apple and a pear shape and what that means in terms of body fat distribution.
So a pear-shaped individual, this is kind of a section through the midsection, We all have subcutaneous fat, which gives us insulation and keeps us warm. Pear-shaped person has quite a lot of fat around the muscle of the thigh and the hip, whereas an apple-shaped person has much less fat around there. They have more subcutaneous fat, but the main difference is that the fat that lies around the organs in the abdomen, that's called visceral fat. There's a lot more fat in there in an apple-shaped person than there is in a pear-shaped person. And this is the fat that is actually active, and it secretes a wide range of chemicals which can set off inflammatory reactions within the body. And it's thought that this is the fat that can lead to the predisposition of apple-shaped obese individuals to develop more serious illnesses such as cancer and cardiovascular disease.
You see, what's happening is that the image of what's under the sand is being projected over the exact spot where the head is. Often, a D miner can spend 90% of his time getting rubbish out of the ground, not mines. I'm Connie Windsor. I work with the Cullum Centre for Fusion Energy.
How does holographic radar work? What is the mechanism behind
it? It's very simple. The sensor is very light, half a kilogram, takes only a few watts of power, same sort of frequency as a mobile phone. Even less power than a mobile phone, and it sends this little radar signal down through the sand or earth, bumps off the objects under the ground like the mines, and it's very sensitive to the exact depth of every object. So you get a pretty picture which has the profile of the object, and it's really quite suitable for looking at, say, with a computer. And the computer can search around for a mine that we know to be in a given minefield and distinguish that from bits of shrapnel and old shell cases and squashed Coke cans, and that's the sort of thing that minefields are full of.
And over here it looks like we've got a group of students from the Sittingbourne Community College who've put together a really neat exhibition on how to become an Olympic athlete. Let's go see what they have.
This is a peak flow meter. It tells us how healthy your lungs are.
Okay.
So it tells us if you've got asthma, if you smoke, or if you've got very healthy lungs. So
okay. Can I try it? Yeah.
Yeah. Just put your mouth over it and blow into it.
Okay.
Don't mind me. How old are you?
23.
23. That is good for a 23-year-old woman. But men normally are getting 550, 600, and women are 300 to 450.
We want to know if you can build a leg better than ours in under 5 minutes.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Okay. I'm up for the challenge. Let's try this. This is really hard. I don't even know what I'm doing. I'm just pushing. Are all the pieces in here to make a proper leg?
Yeah.
I think it's pretty much a lost cause.
Heather Christie there at the Royal Society's Summer Science Exhibition. Join in our Facebook group, where we've handily called ourselves the Guardian Science Weekly Podcast, where you can interact with other listeners, post comments on the wall, that sort of thing. And we'll also let you know every Monday when a new podcast is uploaded. That's it for this week's podcast. Thanks to Ian Sample and David Adam, and our guest Hiranya Pieris. Next week, we're going to take you on a tour around a new exhibition as it's launched at the UK's National Space Centre in Leicester. And we'll be listening in to that Guardian Climate Gate debate. And you can get tickets for that, by the way. There's a link on our blog. Just wanted to say a big thanks to everyone who's been commenting on our blogs and Facebook walls and on Twitter. Lots of great, insightful, thought-provoking and kind messages too. Keep it up. Especially to Dan Marshall, who was making comments about the scarcity of the world's resources. And he says, "Thanks for Science Weekly. It's my favourite thing to listen to as I rush towards the cliff with the rest of you. It brought a tear to producer Andy's eye." Well, we're glad to be with you as well, Dan. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. While you're there, you can subscribe so you can make sure that every podcast gets automatically delivered to your MP3 player. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth, with thanks to Heather Christie. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.